litigation that'll be going on between council and the court. Does anybody have any questions about how we're going to proceed? If not, we are ready to hear South Hartsel Grazing versus Wagner Myers.
Your Honors, this is the first time I've been in front of the Court of Appeals. Please instruct me if I'm...
I'm trying to keep you between the fences. Is that okay?
That sounds like a plan. I'm happy with that. This is a case where the attorney involved basically abandoned Mr. Wagner while the case was ongoing and did not keep him apprised of the next events, did not do any discovery, did not answer the complaint. You've seen the record. It's full of motions for extensions of time. Those extensions passed without answer.
Excuse me, counsel, that before you go any further, to ask you, I want to make sure that you are Mr. Glenn.
I am, yes, sir.
Attorney of record for Wagner.
Dallas Glenn, attorney of record for Lynn Wagner, attorney number 26973.
Thank you.
The end result of this whole thing was Mr. Wagner's defenses were left untouched, except for, you know, almost untouched.
Default and default judgments were entered without,
yes, they were,
without the presence or participation or defense from the Wagner entities.
Right, yes,
sir. Is that safe to say?
Yes, sir. It's and on the date of the default, when the default entered, Mr. Wagner wasn't present. His attorney wasn't present. His attorney later left a letter, self-styled sworn statement in the court record that said she was not notified of this. The default entered. Mr.
That
was,
but that letter postdates the entry of the order, does it not? Or at least it was filed after the judgment had entered.
That letter postdates the entry of judgment.
I mean, after everything's over, this letter appears.
Yes.
I've reviewed some of the record, a good deal of the record, and I can't see anywhere where there's any firm representation made by Mr. Wagner or anyone else about the relationship with this counsel and what happened to this counsel.
Counsel entered her appearance.
I know what happened. I mean, I know she entered her appearance and didn't do anything after that except ask for a motion for extension, perhaps. But there's no clear indication why she didn't, either from Mr. Wagner or from her.
There is no clear indication why she didn't.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry, Mr. Glenn, go ahead.
Why she didn't pursue the case? Why she wasn't actively involved in the case? There is nothing in the record that explains that. However, she did enter her appearance. She was counsel of record, and she did not withdraw.
Mr. Glenn, if I can, oh, I'm sorry.
Please, go ahead.
Were you finished? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm finished.
All right. It sounds to me, in my understanding of your argument, really goes to excusable neglect. And there are plenty of cases, and you cite them,
yes,
that says gross negligence can constitute excusable neglect. I get all that. I really have a procedural issue. Mr. Ank claims in his brief that the excusable neglect was never argued below, that it comes up for the first time here on appeal. I'd like to know from you whether you agree with that, whether it was raised below or not. If it was not raised below, I guess I ask the question, how it's properly before us, how is it preserved for us to hear it?
The issue was not raised below in motion, any paperwork that was filed. However, the court was put on notice that there was a failure, significant failure, in the attorney-client relationship. When nothing was filed, the default date came, no one showed up. The default was entered that date, and then Mr. Ragnar filed motions, pro se, to seek to have that judgment withdrawn.
But his arguments, as I remember them, and please correct me if I'm remembering incorrectly, was basically he had a defense. I don't think he ever raised an issue about his counsel was negligence, you know, or anything like that.
That issue was not raised. However, I feel it incumbent on the court, on the district court, to make inquiry when it is put so much on notice of a failure of the attorney-client relationship, of the attorney neglecting the client to that degree. The court is on notice and should make inquiry.
But can you cite any case law on that, Mr. Glenn? My concern, just be candid with you, is, I mean, that puts the court in a position of being an advocate. I mean, that's, most people, I think, would criticize the court for jumping in and advocating a position if nobody does.
The court is an advocate, yes, Your Honor, the court is an advocate for justice. That is the key here. That is the most important thing we need to keep in mind. Justice was denied Mr. Ragnar because he was unable, because he relied on counsel, because he was unable to present meritorious defenses, and because he was unable to be represented at all in this proceeding. He hired counsel, and counsel disappeared, essentially.
You say there's a breakdown with counsel, and that appears in the briefs also, as I recall. But nobody explains what the nature of that breakdown was. Nobody explains on this record whether there's some limitation on the retention of that counsel or what that counsel was retained to do.
Your Honor, I think the record is clear that this counsel was retained, that counsel was retained to represent Mr. Ragnar's interests in that case, in this case, on appeal, at the trial level. That attorney was hired to represent Mr. Ragnar and failed to do so. Failed to keep him informed, failed to present any defenses, failed to present an answer. And that entire breakdown, I think it's clear from the record that the relationship broke down so significantly that the trial court should have been on notice.
Go ahead.
I just want to get back to this advocacy position again. I believe that the courts of this state at all levels are advocates for justice. And if they, I don't believe that they can take the position that if we see something wrong, we're going to simply ignore it. If it's not brought to our attention in the paperwork, we can pass on it. We can just rule however we choose. I think that's an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, because the court is the third branch of government. It is meant
to have, but you have two contending parties, both of whom are here for a fair hearing, for a hearing on the merits, if you will. And if you keep putting off things until one side gets its ducks in order, the side that the other side is then prejudiced, is it not?
I don't think that's the case in this matter, Your Honor. The other side is not prejudiced in any way. The defenses are there. The arguments are there. We could go back into court Mr. Wagner could go back into court and present his defenses. Mr. Ink could present his arguments.
Mr. Glenn, you've said a few times the court was on notice, that there was a breakdown. Could you be more specific? What exactly should have alerted the court that you say that the court should have jumped in?
The court should have jumped in.
But what put the court on notice? Here's what my concern is, and you can address it. The same could pretty much be said about any default judgment. Anytime there's counsel of record who blows an answer and a default judgment is entered, any party could come in and say, the court should have done something. There was a counsel of record. The court should have known. Counsel should have filed an answer. Therefore, since it's always in the best interest of everybody to rule on the merits, we should just vacate the default because the court should have figured out the counsel should have filed an answer. And I'm trying to figure, and that concerns me, that kind of precedent, because, you know, there's a reason we have a default judgment rule. And I'm wondering, you know, what maybe there's something different in this case that separates it from the hypothetical I just gave you.
In this case, there is.
Okay.
Mr. Wagner filed motions pro se while represented by counsel. And I think that.
What did they say? Did they say anything about his concern about counsel? Or can you? I really want you to be more specific. You've said generally the court was on notice. Is it just that he filed pro se motions? Because I'll tell you, we see that all the time in criminal cases. I mean, with a lawyer appointed, the defendant's filing stuff. I recognize this, of course, isn't a criminal case. But what put the court on notice that there was a breakdown? Or maybe it's just there were pro se motions.
I think it's predominantly the pro se motions. But could I take a time out, Your Honor, and peruse the record for a moment?
Sure.
How do I do that?
Well, you can't take a timeout on your time. I shouldn't speak for the presiding judge here, but you got 3 minutes and 30 seconds left.
I'd like to reserve a little time for rebuttal, if I might.
You might.
Police Court, Dale Ink, registration 14395, appearing on behalf of the Appalachia South Hartsell Grazing Association. Counsel? As I listened to the appellant's argument and the questions from the bench, it's clear that. I'm going to stand here and rehash everything that you guys have already read, at the risk of sounding somewhat informal. The issue of the excusable neglect under Rule 60 was not raised at the trial court level. There was no opportunity to address that at that level. Certainly, had that issue been raised, it would have been addressed in a hearing. Counsel would have appeared. The issue of the scope of the representation that counsel had been retained to provide would have been addressed. Counsel's file would certainly have been available for discovery to review whatever communications may have occurred between counsel and Mr. Wagner. We would have had an opportunity to see, for example, whether or not notice was given to Mr. Wagner by counsel, and that he was advised no response would be filed for any reason. Perhaps there had been a breakdown in the payment to counsel. Perhaps there had been a breakdown in communication between counsel from Florida and counsel from, I believe it's Breckenridge. All of those issues could have been addressed. Unfortunately, as counsel for the appellant has stated, that issue was not raised at that at the trial court level, where we could have addressed these issues and had the trial court an opportunity, given the trial court an opportunity to rule on those issues.
Strank, if I can ask you, was there, and I'm going from memory, but I think the principal issue that was raised in seeking to set aside the default, and I recognize I think there were pro se pleadings, was mainly that there were defenses here. Am I remembering correctly?
That's my recollection as well,
right, Judge. Was there anything, I recognize this may be an unfair question since I'm asking to argue the other side, was there anything, if we were to hypothetically say, we're going to give the appellant here all the benefit of the doubt and read their pleadings very liberally, is there anything that you can point to, asking you as an officer of the court, that would have put the trial court on notice that there was some issue with counsel?
I believe, Judge Gabriel, there was a statement in one of the motions where, in one of the pro se motions, where Mr. Wagner stated, made just a simple statement that Sean Parris had been asked to initiate an inquiry or was looking into conduct of counsel. But that's as close as it ever got to having anything in front of Judge Groom that would have advised him there's problem. I mean, there was no expansion on that statement as to why he would look into. I don't even remember if Mr. Parris was identified as an attorney. I don't recall. I would defer to the content of the record for that. But I just recall that reference was made in one of the pro se pleadings filed to set aside the default.
I very much appreciate your candor and your professionalism in that.
Wasn't there some indication on the record that out of state counsel was going to be entering an appearance pro hoc vis made by the original counsel?
I believe that is correct, Judge. I do recall a it may have been in the motion for an extension of time that was filed by counsel from Breckenridge, I believe, wherein she referenced, I believe it was counsel from Florida, would be seeking to be admitted pro hoc vice and to appear in this case for Mr. Wagner. Again, no such motion was ever made, no such appearance was ever filed by out-of-state counsel, but there was that, I believe it was a single reference. I don't recall more than one.
Assuming that there was some indication in the pro se motions that there was a breakdown in the relationship between Wagner's and their counsel, just assuming that, how do you respond to Mr. Glenn's argument that the court should have been on notice of that and should have done something about it?
Again, Judge Hawthorne, at the risk of sounding somewhat flip, I believe Judge Gabriel's already answered that question, but I don't think you can put the trial courts in the position of acting as advocates for parties who have defaulted, whether it's pro se parties or parties with counsel. If that is to be the standard for trial courts, then I'm afraid that, and I don't like defaults any better than anybody else does. I mean, sometimes they happen, but then I'm afraid that that we've come to the point that the trial court essentially is going to be acting as an advocate, as Judge Gabriel has pointed out, for the defaulting party. The moving party comes in, makes the motion. Trial court looks at the record and says, "Well, wait a minute. These guys have lawyers. We're going to make sure." And there's mechanisms in the rules to address that as well. In this case, counsel of record received notification of they received a copy of the pleading that was filed. They received a copy of the notice of the hearing that was filed. So notice had been given to counsel of record. The lack of participation, I don't think we can impose duty on trial courts to step in at that to inquire further about why is this attorney not here. Certainly that issue, as I said earlier, could have been addressed had this issue been raised at the trial court level. Both counsel from Breckenridge and from Florida would have appeared to testify about what was done or what wasn't done or what the scope of the representation was. So we would be able to answer the questions. But I don't think we want to get to the point where we impose a duty on a trial court that not only is the trial court the finder of fact and the applier of the law, but they are also going to have to act as an advocate for a party who hasn't had any appearance or participation from counsel of record. So I hope that answered your question.
Thank you.
Thank you. The simple fact of the matter is the law is clear that if you don't raise the issue at the trial court level to where we have an opportunity to explore it, it's waived. That's what happened here. I suppose taking it to the next step, even if this court was to find that that single mention about Mr. Parris's inquiry was enough to raise the issue of excusable neglect of counsel, which I don't think it did because there was no affidavit from anyone demonstrating that that had occurred, there still was an insufficient presentation for the trial court to conclude that there was either excusable neglect or meritorious defenses. We have I believe we had two or three page pleadings filed, which contained a laundry list of, I think I can prove this, I think I can prove that, I think I can prove this, as defenses, but nothing beyond that, no factual basis upon which any of those defenses might have rested, no affidavit from counsel saying, yeah, I got the notice, I dropped the ball, I screwed up. There was a complete lack of any evidence upon which Judge Groom could have done anything differently than what he did here. And therefore, we would ask court affirm the judgment from the trial court. And I believe, as I asked in my brief, that the case be remanded to the trial court for the determination of award of additional attorney's fees on the appeal. The note in question provides for an award of attorney's fees. Judge Groom awarded attorney's fees through the course of the case at that point. I don't remember the specific citation, but there is a case that specifically addresses an award of attorney's fees on an appeal, and I believe the language from the appellate court was that if attorney's fees are awarded at the trial court level, we cannot allow that award to be depleted or reduced by not awarding attorney's fees on the appeal. I'm paraphrasing, but we would ask that that this court remand the case to the trial court for that purpose.
Thank you,
counsel. You're welcome.
Your Honor, I believe that on page 67 of the record, contained in the motion, request for default judgment to be set aside, dated July 27, 2009, filed. In the last paragraph, under, and I'm not sure, there is a statement. It says, Attorney Sean Parris has requested investigative action against Darren Meacham and Colleen O'Leary relevant to this case. This was filed pro se by Ronan Wagner, and that was after the default entered on 7/20/09. That, plus the fact that he was filing pro se twice after the default entered, should have put the trial court on notice that there was a real problem in this representation. The neglect of counsel, gross neglect of counsel, shouldn't fall on the defendant.
Something. Let me ask you a question. I'll ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Enck. Let's assume that that particular sentence in that pro se motion was sufficient to put the trial court on notice that there was a serious problem between the Wagner parties and their attorney. What authority do you have to show us that the trial court was then obligated to do something about that situation?
The authority And I don't have a citation. The authority of the court to do justice to the parties should allow the trial court to overrule its default judgment and bring the parties before the court so that the court can make inquiry into whether or not the attorney-client relationship had broken down.
Counsel, I might agree with you that the trial court has an obligation to make sure that a manifest injustice does not occur in the court. Where is there in this record evidence, other than the fact that counsel failed to file an answer, that would indicate that a manifest injustice is occurring here?
The manifest injustice is shown by Mr. Wagner's pro se filings alleging that he has defenses.
But we have a layman alleging legal defenses, but he has them without telling us what they are or what factual support there is for
it. Your Honor, a layman can't do that.
I understand that, and that's part of the problem.
Layman doesn't have the right to...
The lack of evidence is not evidence.
A layman doesn't have the ability to do discovery, doesn't have the ability to totally investigate the claims that Mr. Wagner was making, and that would require discovery, subpoenas, talking to people, getting records, and to prove up his defenses would require an attorney. And there wasn't one here.
We appreciate both parties' arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. The next case is People of the State of Colorado versus Daryl Manson. Counsel are present. If you come forward, we'll take that case as soon as you're ready.